welcome to People Rise Up here on your community-supported radio station, KBOO, where I'm more than happy to let you know that this program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and by the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper. Reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. More information is available at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. So, welcome to People Rise Up. My name is Andrew Geller, and this week we are going to revisit a common topic here on the program, and that is genetic engineering of food crops in specific. There has been 10 solid years now of commercially available genetically modified food, mostly here in the U.S. I think the first one was introduced here in the U.S., the Flavor Saver tomato, which nobody liked. And we're going to be talking about that first decade of what critics are contending has been absolute failure, kind of unanimously. And my guest this morning, joining me to talk about this, I'm very pleased to have on the phone, Juan Lopez. Juan is the coordinator of the GMO campaign for Friends of the Earth International. And I'd like to welcome you to the program, Juan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good morning. Yeah, right. Juan's joining us here from Holland. Is that where you are?
I'm in Florence, Italy.
Oh, you're in Florence. Okay. Well, again, thank you very much for joining us. And Friends of the Earth International put a report out not very long ago called A Decade of Failure regarding the first 10 years of the agricultural genetic modification. And just broadly, and we'll dive into more detail on many of these, can you give us some different facets of the failure of genetic engineering of food crops as you see it?
Well, in the beginning of the 90s, biotech corporations made a lot of promises around the potential of GM crops to tackle fundamental problems in agriculture, like reducing pesticides, producing food with better quality, producing more food. Since the beginning of the commercialization of GM crops, the first one happened in the U.S. in '94, a GM tomato. Since today, 10 years later, the conclusion that we have come to is that basically those promises has been unfulfilled, and there is a clear failure of promoting and introducing GM crops in the world.
Okay, so let's look at some of these in a little bit more detail. First, the issue and kind of the primary issue at the core of the concern about GMOs is their safety. And the industry seems to want to have it both ways. They want to be able to claim, and this is what's been done here in the U.S., that there's no difference between conventionally grown food and genetically modified food, but at the very same time, you're allowed to patent it because it's a completely novel creation. So let's address the safety of these a little bit more. What evidence exists to seriously draw into question the safety of this genetically modified materials?
Well, you have rightly pointed one of the clear contradictions that between the claims that industry made and the reality. On one side, they claim that GMOs are safe and there's no difference with in comparison with the conventional counterparts. But on the other side, they are patenting those GM crops. And also, I mean, they have been refusing to accept liability for any damage, despite they are saying they are so safe. Basically, the conclusion that many studies have come to in the last 10 years about the safety of GM crops, particularly also in the U.S., is that the legal system, the regulatory system existing, cannot guarantee the safety of GM crops, because there are no mandatory safety testing that can ensure that those GM crops are safe. And on the other side, there are many, many studies which raise many uncertainties and many potential risks which are completely not assessed at all by the studies that have been performing in the regulatory systems, like, for example, the U.S., where the companies only have the only voluntary submit studies on the safety of GM crops, and there's not a full comprehensive revision of those studies, and therefore the safety cannot be guaranteed.
Now, another issue that critics, I guess from the start, we're saying was a possibility and has been documented in, I don't know about scientific literature, but in newspaper articles, that it's possible to transfer the genetic, the modified DNA material from foods ingested into the human digestive system.
Yes, there are some studies 1 year and a half ago, more or less, which show for the first time that the GM traits were able to go through the human digestive gut, something that the biotech industry denied in the past. Basically, since the very beginning, there have been many of the claims that the industry made initially have been proved to be wrong. Initially, they believed that it would be very rare to have horizontal gene transfer and gene contamination between GM crops. 10 years later, it's obvious and it is overproof that GM contamination happened between GM crops, that the pollen can travel really long distances. And we have, for example, cases in Canada where we have accumulation or a gene stack of different gene traits in plants where there was not supposed to be those traits. So basically many, many examples of unwanted things are happening today when in the beginning we were told that it would be very, very rare that this could happen.
Yeah, and we've covered that issue in specific here on the program and other shows on KBOO, and Percy Schmeiser is probably the best known person, I suppose globally, to have dealt with that issue, having legally challenged claims Monsanto made about his supposed theft of their DNA by cross-contamination with his canola crop up there. And, you know, it's a really, I mean, in a sense, the industry has a very clever business model, and I'm sure their internal data reveals a lot more than what they publicly admit. But the idea that you can claim ownership of something by pollution, because that's basically what that tactic is the cross-pollination spreads their proprietary genes, and they can then theoretically say, well, now those are our plants too, because our proprietary DNA is in there. Has there ever been any discovery of that idea as a tactic, or is it more thought of as, oh, it's accidental, but we might as well take advantage of it? Or do you know?
Well, we really believe that there is a strategy behind the scenes. I mean, it's not that we have documentation proving that there is a voluntary tactics, but it's, if you follow the examples and the pattern of similar cases all over the world, there is a clear say that you contaminate first and then you legalize the contamination later on. Mm-hmm. It's not about preventing contamination. That's what we believe it should be, have been always. But basically, we have examples in India where in 2002, illegal varieties of GM cotton are found in the fields and immediately destroyed. But later on, they legalized it. In Brazil, we had also in 1999, there was a ban on the introduction of GM soya. Later on, a few years later, Monsanto and other companies pushed for the legalization, and just 2 years ago, less than 2 years ago, the government of Brazil authorized temporarily the legal planting of GM soya. So there are many examples all over the world where we can really come through the similar pattern, which for us we interpret as a real tactic behind the scenes.
Now, another one of the major claims the industry has put out over the past decade is that GMO crops would be of higher quality, more nutritious, and greater yield, while at the same time utilizing fewer pesticides and herbicides. Can you briefly address those claims sort of as a group, because they do tie in together?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in the claim of fewer pesticides, I think you have already some studies already done on the U.S. and mm-hmm. I'm referring to the United States and Canada, because it's the countries where there's more experience with GM crops. Some studies by Dr. Benbrook, which prove that it is not true, the claim of in the case of GM soya, it's not true the claim that fewer pesticides have been used. On the contrary, more pesticides, more quantity of active ingredients in the pesticides have been used around the U.S., and it's increasing after subsequent croppings of the GM soya. On the yields, we have really not evidence neither. In the case of soya and maize, really substantial and significant evidence that this has happened. And on the terms of quality, it's basically clear that there has been no improvement at all in the quality of the maize or of the soya delivered today by the GM industry. There are a lot of promises again that there will be a second generation of nutritional and high quality GM crops that will be delivered in the next 10 years, but again, it's just a promise, and we would like to remind that they already promised this 10 years ago.
Now, and connected to that, again, there's the issue of gene transfer going to wild relatives of the domesticated crops, but then there's also the issue of non-target species being impacted, and this more specifically deals with plants that have been engineered to actually contain a toxin, a pesticide, mostly BT, which I'm not going to try and deal with the Latin of that. But BT is a compound that the organic industry is able to use, and it's been widely suspected that by engineering plants to contain BT, you will reduce the effectiveness of it in the organic sector, because insects of all types will become less impacted by it, because they will basically build up a tolerance, a resistance to it. And again, this is the Benbrook study that you referenced, 1999 report, which looked at over 8,000 field trials of herbicide-resistant crops, found that farmers planting Roundup Ready soy needed 2 to 5 times more herbicide. Not 2 to 5%, 2 to 5 times more. And again, something that I guess we haven't mentioned quite yet, remember that genetic engineering of food crops is done almost exclusively, not entirely, but almost, to have herbicide resistance. That is the trait they're going for. They're not engineering it for greater nutrition. They're not engineering it for greater yield. They're engineering these plants to be able to sustain or to be able to continue growing with much heavier doses of, in many cases, Roundup, which is the large income generator for Monsanto Corporation. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. We're talking about the first decade of genetic modification of food crops. My guest today is Juan Lopez. He's the coordinator for the Genetically Modified Organism Campaign at Friends of the Earth International. You can find out more about them online at www.foei.org, and then just click on campaigns and go to GMOs. And the People Rise Up webpage at kboo.fm has links to them, as well as many other organizations, reports, and sources of information about GMOs, and even more stuff will go up there later this morning. So let's take a look at the differences in regulation or prohibition on genetically modified foods between the U.S. and, let's look mostly at Europe, because, well, that's where you are, and Europe's got some of the strongest restrictions in the world. But let's also keep in mind that the U.S. really stands out in the world for its most open perspective on allowing GMOs in food. Why do you feel Europe has been so successful in enacting restrictions and moratoria on GMOs?
Basically, there's one fundamental difference between the U.S. system and the European system, and it's based on the initial approach to the issue. And in the U.S., in the 80s, there was a clear political decision to consider GM crops substantial equivalent to their conventional counterparts, and therefore they decided not to create a specific regulation for GM crops, but use the existing legislation on pesticides, food additives, and know a specific framework. In the framework that the European Union created in the 90s, they really make a clear difference because they create a specific framework on genetic modified organisms. So basically, there was already an assumption that GMOs are different. The biotech industry at that time, the government, they still believe that the world will really follow and accept the policy decision that was made in the United States to consider GM crops substantial equivalent, and that there will be no problems to accept the GM maize, GM soya that was hugely significantly produced in the United States, Canada, and Argentina. But around 96, 97, the concerns start to grow, and at the international level, many countries started to call for a United Nations agreement to regulate GM crops, because many countries in the world were already afraid that they will become the dumping grounds of genetic modified products not properly regulated. That's why in 2000 it was created an international biosafety protocol, where clearly the essence and the only existence of the biosafety protocol is already an international agreement that contradicts the policy adopted in the United States, that basically says that GMOs are different. GMOs are different from their conventional counterparts and therefore require specific regulation. This is a fundamental distinction between the approaches of the U.S. and EU and many other countries in the world. And basically, most of the countries in the world are really following the approach that was taken by the European Union and not the U.S. So this is already a clear breakthrough that shows that the standards that have been adopted at international level, the U.S. have not been able, and the biotech industry, to really make the world accept just the GMOs as substantially equivalent as other organisms.
Now, you cite the very early kind of fundamental notion that European lawmakers and related folks understood that there was a difference between GMOs and conventionally grown. And when I'm talking about conventionally grown, I include organics, because organics is a type of conventional agriculture in the context of GMOs. But I'm curious what you feel, or how much you feel, the public's sentiment or public questioning of the safety and even need for GMOs in food in Europe contributed to the continuing strength of opposition to GMOs in Europe.
Yes, basically, I mean, the controversy over the safety of GM food, and the second point you mentioned, the inability of the biotech industry to show the benefits of the GM crops they have been produced, really determine the position of the public in Europe. I mean, the public, the consumer in Europe, simply ask themselves the question, I mean, why should we accept this GM food that they are offering us when there is no real benefit? We have nothing to win with this. And in addition, there are a lot of potential risks which seem not addressed by the current regulatory system of the countries which are exporting those foods. I think that there was an overwhelming answer to that question, in the sense that we don't want them. And we don't need to, basically the failure why the consumer and the public decide to take that position. It reflects the failure of the biotech industry and the first generation of GM crops, because they decided to introduce into the market very quickly a product which was not enough tested, and they rushed into the market in order to maximize economic benefit, when there was no proper assessment and the products that they were delivering were really not going to convince the consumers that they were absolutely needed.
Quoting a little bit here from the Friends of the Earth International report, A Decade of Failure, Dr. Richard Horton, editor of the British scientific magazine The Lancet, says, "Seeking a technological food fix for world hunger may be the most commercially malevolent wild goose chase of the new century." And the international relief organization Christian Aid, also therein, says, "Biotechnology and GM crops are taking us down a dangerous road, creating the classic conditions for hunger, poverty, and even famine. Ownership and control concentrated in too few hands and a food supply based on too few varieties of crops planted widely are the worst option for food security." And it's really food security that is the kind of core issue around this. I mean, the industry talks about wanting to feed the world hungry, but it's not production that's the problem. It's the distribution mechanisms in place that are primarily responsible for people going hungry, both here in the U.S. and probably in places in Europe, but primarily in what's referred to erroneously often as the Global South. And the issue of GMOs reared up in the context of food aid, and the U.S. primarily trying to dump unwanted genetically modified foodstuffs on countries that, for whatever reason, in that specific case, didn't have enough food for it, part of its population in a certain area. And the industry used the rejection of the GMO food aid as evidence in their mind that, you know, the governments of these countries didn't really care about these people, and the U.S. and the industry were trying to, you know, really just help out, and, you know, no ulterior motive involved. How has the issue of GMO food aid and dumping moved in either direction since the rejection by a few African countries of that food aid in the past year or two?
Well, this has been a crucial issue that really become extremely hot in 2002. And we just need to look at the facts. And in this case, who was saying what, and what was the reality at the end? In this case, you have rightly pointed that the biotech industry, the U.S. administration, they were strongly criticizing those African leaders for the rejection of GM food aid, on the grounds that they even said in one occasion that these leaders should be taken to the International Court of Justice, mm-hmm, for crimes against humanity because of the rejection of GM crops, and let their people die. And what is the reality of today of countries like Zambia, which was the only country which rejected GM food aid entirely? I mean, milled and also a seed. 2 years later, in 2002, despite the assertions by the biotech industry and the U.S. organizations on the ground that without GM food aid, they will not be able to cope with the crisis, 2 years later, Zambia proved that they overcome the crisis without the use of GM food aid, and even this year and last year, they were even able to export food to the region. It's a fact, it's a reality that really shows that the claims, again, on the need of GMOs to tackle the hunger is a misconception and a claim that has been ongoing for years and years. And we know that the problems of hunger are not directly related to technology. And there are other solutions and other ways to go. And the Zambian story is the living proof that even in situations of emergency, GM food aid is not the key to tackle it.
Now, as we're running short on time, and there's several more things I'd love to discuss, just going to get to one of them here kind of briefly, and that's the effort of the U.S. to utilize the World Trade Organization to force other countries to accept GMOs. Can you tell us where that process is at and what's going on with it?
Well, the U.S. took the European Union to the WTO dispute settlement body in 2003, and at the moment the European Union requested that a scientific committee assess the issue because of the complexity of the issues raised by the U.S. and other countries. And at the moment, we expect that there will be a result of this scientific committee in next year. It is clear a complex issue where we believe that it should have never happened, this case, and the World Trade Organization should not be discussing on safety issues related to GMOs, but should be more on other bodies, as was mentioned before, like the Biosafety Protocol Agreement under the United Nations.
All right. Well, unfortunately, that's what we've got time for this morning, trying to get through a very long, complex issue in a half hour. Is not always a simple thing, but we did what we could. Juan Lopez has been my guest this morning. He's the GMO campaign coordinator for Friends of the Earth International, and you can find out more about them and what they're doing on GMOs and many other campaigns at www.foei.org. It's just the acronym for Friends of the Earth International, FOEI.org. Thanks a whole lot for joining us this morning, Juan.
Or
this,
thank you.
Or this evening, as you, your case is.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
All right. Take care, Juan.
Bye.
Bye. And so off he goes, and I just want to let you know that now that you're all kinds of interested in genetically modified organisms and food and want to do something about it, you happen to live in an area where there's a chapter of Resistance Against Genetic Engineering. Northwest Resistance Against Genetic Engineering has office space in Southeast Portland at 34th and Belmont. They have meetings, I believe, monthly. Maybe it's twice a month. Wait, look, because of technology, I can be on the computer and the radio at the same time. And let's see if it says when their next meeting is. I don't see it. However, you can go to their website at www.nwrage, that's northwestrage.org. You can also call them at 503-239-6841. Northwest Rage works to ban genetic engineering, ban patents on all life forms, a ban on biopiracy, ban cloning of humans and animals, and a whole bunch of other really good stuff. So go check their website out. It's got lots and lots of really great categorized information, makes it pretty easy to navigate around. And, you know, it's your local opportunity to plug on in. So that's what I got time for today. Coming up next, we'll be making contact, speaking about the 20th anniversary of the Bhopal gas leak in India. Next week, I'll be doing the first People Rise Up Christmas program, and it's not what you think it might be. But in the meantime, here's an announcement for an upcoming food-related program, and I will be talking to you next week. You got any questions or comments? You can send me email at kboo@riseup.net, and the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm has links to a whole lot of information about today's and the past 3 months or so worth of programs. Thanks a whole lot for listening.